Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, August 1st. Today we hear from Maui residents as we approach the one-year mark of this country's worst fatal wildfire. A recently released study from the University of Hawaii Medical School looks at some worrisome health trends across the Pacific Islands. We'll learn more about a new film shot on the Big Island and starring Hawaii actor Branscombe Richmond, who is also marking his 50th year in the movie industry. And while America Ninja Warrior fans await the return of the show after the Olympics, we revisit our interview with Island Ninja Grant McCartney. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This month marks a year since the wildfire swept through Maui. There are a number of events scheduled on the Valley Isle, including a paddle out on the morning of the 8th, as well as a memorial event in the evening to honor those who we lost in the blaze. Government officials are expected to provide an update on efforts to take care of the many families who lost loved ones and homes in the blaze. HPR's Maui Nui reporter Catherine Kulik-Pactel joins us this morning.
Good morning.
So what's the feeling over there?
Well, I've been talking with fire survivors, you know, over the past year, checking in with them, seeing how they're doing at different points in this really rough process for them. And I first talked with Charles Nahale back in December. It was before the holidays. And he talked about being, you know, in temporary housing at that point. He was still in a condo. And then he was transferred to a hotel without a kitchen, and he was there for quite some time and talked about the challenges of that, just logistically. And then finally in April, he went to sign a contract on a FEMA direct lease unit, but things didn't go as he hoped.
5 months later, when I finally, the day I'm going to go out of the hotel and into this unit that FEMA and I have chosen, I get there, and that unit isn't anything like FEMA promised. The contract even has a different spec than the actual space. The space was a studio. The bed was like in the kitchen. The contract said it's a one-bedroom, recently remodeled, but it wasn't anything like the contract said. It was run down. Drawers were broken. There was a leak in the toilet. There was no one to contact to get that fixed. I was heartbroken because I had waited so long to get out of the hotels into a place that has a kitchen. And when I went into that space and saw what that space was like, brokenhearted, I thought, I can't live here.
Oh gosh, you can just feel his pain.
Absolutely. Such a frustrating experience. And he said after he had that experience, he found out a lot of other folks had the same experience. They were turning down FEMA units because of their condition. And he says that FEMA used management companies, as we know, that they're based on the mainland. And he found that they were very disconnected. They weren't available to him to contact with these issues that he had. There was no one there, as he said. And he didn't sign the contract for that place because he said, you know, I can't live here. He waited another 2 months. He was back in a hotel. And then finally he heard from FEMA that they had found another potential place. And so he went to inspect a one-bedroom unit in West Maui. And when he was there, he learned from his experience. He was more educated this time around. And he insisted on doing a full walkthrough of the unit before he signed a contract. And he found what he called over $1,000 in repairs that needed to be done. So certain things that weren't working, that were in disrepair. So FEMA said they'll fix them, which is great. But that took another month. And so he finally moved in to this one-bedroom unit in West Maui last month. And, you know, he's there for now. You know, it's sort of been pegged as a longer term solution. But he says thousands of FEMA leases for these direct lease units are set to expire in February. So that's really not that far away. And he's really worried what will happen to himself and everyone else, you know, thousands of people in these direct lease units whose leases expire in February.
Yeah, that's just 6 months away.
Yeah, it's not that far. And he's like, you know, is everyone going to wind up back on the street? Because even though they are working on building units and temporary solutions, you know, they're not ready yet. And they probably all won't be in the next 6 months. And even if they are, you know, he just said that that's not enough for everybody. So he's worried about what the future will hold. And he was also sharing what he has planned to do this year on August 8th. He said he has more of kind of a personal take on the remembrance that he wants to do, thinking about, you know, his survival of the fire last year. But he told me that he feels like the word anniversary that everyone's been using is more of a celebration, right? And this isn't a celebration for him or anyone who survived the fire. You know, it's more of an observance or a, you know, marking of that 1 year. He said, personally, he doesn't feel like the word anniversary is a good fit. I also talked with Lahaina fire survivor Kahokulea Haiku. And I first spoke with him a little over a month ago, and he was at a beach park where he had been living out of his truck with his dog for the past few months. He survived the fire, spending 14 hours in a parking structure just yards away in Lahaina from where people were jumping into the ocean to save themselves from the blaze. And he did help a lot of other people to that safe area where he was, using a snorkel mask that he had in his truck and water that he thankfully, you know, had in his truck, and really harrowing experience. But he talked about hope being a four-letter word, and he was pretty discouraged when I talked to him last month.
You know, a lot of my good friends and who people who are talented and who are solid members of our little community over there in Lahaina, they left. They gave, you know, they headed out because it is too much. There is trauma. You know, there is a lot that some have decided that it's not worth it, not for their kids. Local people who are born and raised here, you know, and just want the best for our Maui. But then, you know, there comes a time where we all look at each other, the few of us that are still holding that line strong, and we wonder, what Maui are we trying to save? And then who are we saving it for? We need to make sure we take care of the local people, because if the caretakers keep leaving and then the takers come in, right, then all they're doing is taking, taking, taking. And what's going to happen to the caretakers? You know, they're going to give up.
Yeah, you feel for him, you know, his situation.
Absolutely. And I just spoke with him, and he told me that he's just moved into Hale Olaie, which is formerly the Hagai Institute in Kihei, just a few days ago. And it was purchased by the state. About 175 rooms were converted into housing for wildfire survivors, and he's one of the first tenants there. So things are looking up for him there. He talked about how amazing the little things are, like using a toilet, you know, instead of a porta potty, and shaving in a private space instead of in a beach park where tourists, he said, looking at you like you're a crazy person. You know, he appreciates the privacy. But there are some disadvantages with this housing, he says.
I could see in a living situation with kids, it would be hard, because these are more hotel room style. They do not allow cooking. There is no outside cooking on the premises either. But, you know, I would trade that inconvenience for being homeless any day of the week. I have so much compassion and also worry for the other people who are out there that are, you know, displaced and they don't have a place to go. A lot of people in Lahaina do not want to be in Kihei. It's just not where they want to be. Thankfully, I have job opportunities that place me here as well. So this is rather convenient for me. Since the fire, I don't like driving too much. The traffic gives me anxiety. All these reports of fires everywhere drives me crazy. Like, my anxiety wants to jump through the roof. I don't want to drive far to the other side because I'm worried there's going to be a fire and I'm going to get stuck in it.
Yes, that post-traumatic trauma that many people are living with as we watch the news every night.
Absolutely. And he said, you know, of course, he is grateful to be in this housing, but he did mention that there's security that he feels like is keeping a little bit too close of an eye on his whereabouts and things like that. So he understands why it may not be a good fit for everyone. But, you know, it is an option. And it sounds like there's more options coming down the line for fire survivors to find that much needed, a little bit longer term housing.
Yeah, well, I know that you will be back over there again next week with all the different ways that the community is pulling together as we mark this 1 year period of this disaster. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters should contact their county elections division right away if they have not received their primary election ballot. Elections.hawaii.gov.
I trust the science. It's a nice sentiment, but even scientific data can be biased.
There's so many ways that you can cut the data and torture the data until it confesses and gives the result that you want.
How misinformation spreads, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
A new breast cancer study by researchers from the University of Hawaii and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had a surprising top line. It looked at disease rates in the six U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands, Guam, the Northern Mariana Islands, American Samoa, Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia. The study found lower rates of breast cancer in the region compared to the 50 U.S. states. However, the cases were being diagnosed at much later stages, which affects survival rates. Lee Wenkonseho Lam is an associate dean at the UH John A. Burns School of Medicine. She also led the study. The conversation's Maddie Bender talked with her about what to make of the team's findings and how she worked to lower those health disparities in the Pacific.
I'm a family physician by training and had the opportunity when I was a resident to travel to American Samoa for a rotation. And also during my early years as a faculty, had the opportunity to work in depth with physicians and other colleagues from all of the six U.S.-affiliated Pacific Island jurisdictions, and was able to also do some clinical educational rotations in the Republic of the Marshall Islands. So certainly from the American Samoa experience, but even from growing up, you know, I've always been kind of curious about why some people have and others have not, and access and all these other things. But I saw firsthand, you know, some of the challenges that our colleagues face in the U.S. affiliated Pacific Islands. And so in 2000, and for sure 2002, is when my work really started with our colleagues in the Pacific. And we've had several grants. The first one was really to help look at kind of the infrastructure for educating physicians and nurses and others, because, you know, whenever you see health disparities, you have to wonder, well, is it a system? Is it an education of the health providers? Is it an education of patients? You have to look kind of very systematically at all of those things. So that's really how it started.
And when we talk about these health disparities, let's maybe give an example: breast cancer incidence mm-hmm. and diagnosis, and this finding that on the face of it looks like there are positive and negative aspects, right? Because you see lowered incidence in the affiliated Pacific Islands compared to U.S., but then of the cases, they are at later stages.
I think our paper, which we were fortunate to do with our colleagues from the Centers for Disease Control, really shows the challenges with data, right? And how we have to be very critical and ask good questions when we're reading papers. So because the U.S. Pacific jurisdictions tend to have, you know, small numbers of patients, but honestly, mostly because mammography is not widely accessible to almost every population, even in Guam, with the highest percentage of people, you know, saying that they had received recent breast cancer screening, that is maybe 65% compared to the U.S. standard, which is above 80%. But in some jurisdictions, there actually are no mammography. And so if a patient doesn't have access to screening or has such tremendous barriers to receiving care, the case may never get reported. And so we know that that is definitely an issue because parts of Federated States of Micronesia, Republic of the Marshall Islands are actually very remote. You can only get there by boat. You know, in the FSM, they do not have widespread mammography available. I mean, there's one now in a private hospital in Phnom Penh, but you've got like the entire country with just one machine. And so we know that there's geographical barriers anyway, but for those women who were able to come in and get diagnosed, yeah, it's often at very late stages. And so anecdotally, when we started, when our colleagues, our physician colleagues in the Pacific started all of this, they said, you know, individually, we're seeing cancers diagnosed at late stages. We need a system to address this. And so that's really what started over 20 years of partnership with the jurisdictions, because there was no systematic way to even get that data to make the case then to their governments or to our federal government or grants or, you know, anybody to get those resources.
How much is this a challenge of living on a small island compared to how much is this a challenge of being an under-resourced place? Or is that a false dichotomy?
No, it's both, actually. I think being small has tremendous strengths, right? The community strengths, the ability to pull together, get education, those are tremendous community strengths. But when you're in a small population, it's not always possible, feasible, economically sustainable. You've got health resource, like healthcare worker availability, right? All of those things that have to factor into whether or not that locale can support like whatever, right? Whether it's in this case a mammography, mammogram, or clinical trials and chemotherapy, you know? And so in some of the jurisdictions, there's no oncologist even. There's no radiologist. If the mammography is done, they have to have it read by teleradiology, you know, someplace else in another part of the world. So it's both. It's the small population, but it's because that population or that the system in that population may not be able to support that type of full service.
And do you have a sense of how, if this is changing over time, is it getting better? Is it getting worse?
It's definitely getting better. Yeah. The colleagues that we have, I mean, really, we consider them our family now. You know, we've been working at this with them for over 20 years. They've just made tremendous strides. So, you know, when we first started, there were large segments of the population that I think had very little awareness of what cancer was, risk factors. In some of the jurisdictions, they didn't actually have a word in language for cancer. And so then how do you explain this pretty difficult concept, right? And then if it's something in a taboo area, as most female body parts are, then you have to figure out how to say it and promote and do the education, but in a very sensitive and respectful way, knowing that there's such tremendous cultural taboos around that.
There's a point in the study that I like to, despite their cultural and linguistic diversity, these islands share common geographic, economic, and resource limitations that may impede access to cancer screening and follow-up. That makes me think of something that people talk about a lot, which is data disaggregation, data yes. aggregation. When is it appropriate to lump various groups together? And when does that actually hide the signal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is in part why, and so this paper does disaggregate the data by jurisdiction. And, you know, for some of them, we couldn't show the numbers because the numbers were very, very small. But the numbers that we do have tell a pretty bad story in terms of the late stage of diagnosis. When the health leaders of each country agreed to develop this regional registry, this was back in 2006, you know, it was very clear that this is their data, right? It's their country data. have all the right protections, but it is a regional reporting and a roll-up. It's all, you know, de-identified, et cetera. They wanted us to put in some additional fields so that they, as the ministries or departments of health, could actually use that information, not just for cancer, but as a way to, over time, show improvements or not improvements, you know, in their health system. So again, some of this access to care issues, stuff like that. And so every jurisdiction has their own data, but at the local level, you know, we have been able to show disparities that everybody kind of knew, but now it's proven by the data. And that helps the local health departments tailor the outreach. So much like we do here, and why you need to have disaggregated data is so that you can culturally tailor your outreach, education programs, your access, all of those supports. In many cases, you know, your approach needs to be a little bit different.
Looking ahead, what are you hopeful about, or what are some ongoing projects that you think will really start to make a dent?
So I think for breast cancer screening, there are some exciting developments in the diagnostics that are not yet proven, but do need to be evaluated in the Pacific context. And they are things like certain types of ultrasounds or other handheld devices. You know, there's a lot of different things out there now that are used in other countries with very remote locations, parts of sub-Saharan Africa or, you know, parts of Asia, for example. But they still need to be evaluated in the Pacific context. And so what we need to do is see, is it feasible in these different locations? Is it acceptable to the community, to the provider? What are the true costs? Because it's not just the device. You know, there's personnel, there's time, there's, again, the transportation factor, right? There's all these things. And so there is work being done. It's those types of studies that are really important to learn, because anything new, just because it's shiny and bright, doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing. And if it's not going to be used, then that's not a good use of resources when resources are so limited. So yeah, there are a lot of promising technologies out there for earlier diagnosis of cancers, that breast cancer, with cervical cancer, you know, liver cancer in certain populations. Oral cancer is very, very high because of high betel nut use, especially in Yap and in Palau areas, CNMI. So early detection is the key, because the earlier you can detect these, then the more likely it is that they can either be treated on island, or even if they have to be referred, it'll be a much simpler treatment than something that is very advanced stage.
And anything else you want to add, you feel like listeners should know about the research that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think just in general, you know, the word research sometimes is scary to people. But I think just really to think about it is, you know, we want to work with our patients who are not well represented in research or clinical trials. And so I would say, you know, ask your provider good questions. I always encourage my patients to ask lots of questions, being empowered to just ask.
That was Lee Buencanseho-Lum, author of a new study on breast cancer rates in the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands. She was talking to HPR's Maddie Bender. We will have a link to the study on the conversation page of our website after the show. The black barren lava fields of Hawaii Island is the setting for a new film titled At Her Feet. It centers on two college students on a hike with a local guide in the volcano area when an eruption turns their time in the field into an epic adventure. Here's the trailer.
Ready, set, aloha!
I got word that the volcano was closed to tourists. I talked to the superintendent, told him you were coming.
Thank you.
Took a chance of a lifetime.
Yes.
Aloha mai. You must be Dr. Kaleo's two favorite summer interns.
We're really excited for this hike, so.
It's such an honor for me to share the history and culture of this mountain. Let's get your packs. Let's go.
What is it about Hawaii that you love?
It's a spiritual feeling I haven't felt anywhere else I've been.
When we drove into the park, we gave a ride to a woman who was standing in the middle of the road.
Some people who have seen the woman you described believe she's the manifestation of the goddess Pele.
So this is Pele's home. I think I can speak for both of us. We feel honored to be here.
In our mythology, it was Mother Earth that gave birth to Pele as fire, and her sister Namako Kahai as a dragon. Volcanoes erupted. The fissures are opening up. Let's move.
Whoa! Oh my God, look at that.
That's insane.
Okay, if you're interested in taking a real adventure with me, I need your help saving some artifacts. And as fate would have it, two of you are archaeology students.
Doesn't the idea of moving ancient artifacts make you even a little nervous?
I don't even know who I am yet. You know how much this means to me.
If we decide to help you rescue the artifacts, will it put us in more danger than we're already in?
That is a possibility. We have to get off the volcano one way or the other.
Come on, Laura Croft.
Yeah.
It's obviously pretty dangerous, and it could have been a lot worse.
Yes, but even if we don't go to the cave, to get off this mountain, we need to walk in this direction.
This unplanned tour has given us the privilege to witness her endless cycle of life, death, rebirth. Is this epic enough for you?
Oh my God, yes.
And that was a trailer from the film At Her Feet. It was written and directed by Kauai resident Anadia Wind and features nationally acclaimed actor Branscombe Richmond in a supporting role. Richmond is celebrating 50 years in the film and TV industry this year. He broke into the industry as a stuntman and later transitioned into acting and producing. Richmond paid a visit to our studio along with some of his family recently to talk to The Conversation's Russell Subiono.
The film is called At Her Feet.
At Her Feet.
Who is the her in At Her Feet?
I'd be giving the movie away.
Okay.
But it is a person, maybe of a situation that you're going to go, oh, wow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe it's not a person that is of this world.
Oh, okay.
Is that okay? Can I say that?
Yeah.
There you go.
So tell me what the film's about.
Well, I can tell you that this film is about two visiting students who come to learn about Hawaii, to come to visit a volcano and visit the islands and get to know the way of life. They get into a situation that they become a little bit helpful to a native Hawaiian man who also gives tours at the volcano. And as you can see by the poster, the volcano is erupting and they have to provide a service that maybe needs to be done in such a way that it's their virgin experience doing what this man is asking them to do. A little suspenseful and a little bit interesting. And at the same time, these two wonderful young actors are learning about themselves.
If you watch the trailer, you appear in the trailer in a few shots. You have long hair, big beard. You look kind You look kind of scary. What character do you play in the film?
Well, I don't want to give it all away because then you kind of give away the whole movie. But here's what I will say. I play Kaiva. He is a lost soul with a great mission, and his mission is to preserve and to save the Kanaka lifestyle in the lava fields, and he may be misguided, but his intentions are pure.
I've seen some set photos. Looks like some scenes were shot at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island and in the surrounding areas. I also saw a video of heavy rain putting production on hold in the middle of a lava field. What was that experience like filming in a setting that seems to be a little bit more unpredictable than your typical movie set?
You know, God brought us steam. That lava can get really hot.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the sun over there in Kalapana is hitting, it's really hot. Then it rains, and now you've got steam. And, you know, some of those scenes where it looks like there's steam to the volcano in the background.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's what it's from.
God brought us steam. It was really, really wonderful. I got to tell you. What a beautiful place. Not an easy place to kind of roll around, and you'll twist an ankle if you're not careful. You really got to be careful out there.
There are also many myths and legends about the volcano area on the Big Island. And I've heard plenty of stories from productions that shoot in places with strong spiritual ties where unexpected things happen, both good and scary. Did you or anyone on the production team experience anything that couldn't be explained?
Sure. Absolutely. There were things like that, a lot of things. Yeah. And gosh, which one do I pick? You know what? When the sun goes down, I think in many ways, many things do happen. I think the spirits have more freedom at that time. If you're respectful and are kind, I think the spirits know that. But our kupunas are there. I mean, you know, our ancestors are there. And when you say something like that to someone who's not raised or have any roots here or maybe some blood, some coco or something like that, they go, oh, come on, right? They do that thing. But they're driving home after we've wrapped. And they go, you know, I think I saw something. I think I, do you guys have, and then they talk about it. And it just depends how far you want to go with it. But it, in essence, it's always good. It's always safe. It's always pono. And I hope we get times to share with those who have passed on to leave good messages for us who have yet gone.
I want to learn a little bit more about Nadia Nguyen. She's the writer and director of the
producer.
Film. Producer of the film.
Yep. Found the money.
I know she studied film at the University of Texas. I know she moved to Hawaii in 1991. I know she has an interest in social issues and indigenous cultures. What do you know about what prompted her to write this script? What themes did she want to explore in the film?
I'll tell you what. Nadia is a lady with a determined passion. I'll say that. At times, she's a little forceful, and you kind of want to say, come on, Nadia, give us a break. But she has a vision, and she's lived with it all this time, and she's given it her all. And she lives in the Wailua River of Kauai. She's been here a long time. She's not a native person. She is from the continent. And this is her homage to Hawaii. You know, she's gone through some personal things. And hopefully this helps her with her heart and her feelings and becomes a healing time. We all express ourselves in different ways. Some people are singers. Some people are actors. Some people bake cookies. You know what I mean? And Nadia wanted to make a movie, and she made this movie. And so this is how I saw her through my eyes as an actor. I'm also a co-producer of this project. And I also was not the person that was going to play this role.
What?
Yep. So this is a great story. When I got the script, I read it, and I said, okay, this is a great role. Let's have some fun. Let's go and go to Big Island, so forth and so on. All of a sudden, she gives me 5 pages of Olelo Hawaii. And I looked at these 5 pages, and this is a week, 2 weeks before. And I can't get it. You know, she expected me to go like that. Another actor in the show that I recommended is Vinny Chen. And I said, you know, let's have a meeting. So I brought Vinny in a phone conversation with Nadia after I had talked to her. And I said, Nadia, you know, I'm not this guy to play this role now that you've brought 5 pages of Olelo Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But Vinny is. She eased into it. And Vinny is the other lead in the movie. And he's Olelo Hawaii, he's a Kamehameha school grad. So he understood this role that needed to be played. And here's what I will say. Many people make movies about Hawaii. And some people say, oh, you know, they shouldn't have made a movie about Hawaii. And they shouldn't have, that movie's not, that's Disney. And this is, the benefit for us here in Hawaii is that people make movies to see the faces of those who live here in places that may never had an opportunity to show our faces. If you're going to leave it up to the guys in the big buildings on the continent to come up with an idea, don't wait for them. Create it. No matter if it's good, bad, or indifferent, you're getting a knowledge of Polynesia, Asian people, Filipino people, people who live here. I think it's important. Because most of our industry is not about people of the South Pacific. And I can tell you that since this is 50 years for me. August 8 will be 50 years.
Right. That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard.
Is that a long time?
Nah.
Okay.
Nah.
Good.
Yeah. Spring chicken.
Spring chicken. You're here.
Well, speaking of your 50th year in the film and television industry, I know you've been in just hundreds of productions. Film,
you know,
TV.
When you work cheap, everybody hires you. Just wanted you to know that.
Well, I mean this in the most playful way possible. Being in the industry for 50 years is such a monumental accomplishment. Have you ever turned down a role?
Not really. You know, I know what I can do. So I got a bag of tricks. You know, every actor, you have a bag of tricks and you go to it when you need it. And you see something and you put that trick and you stick it in your bag. I've never turned a role down, but I mean, and what you see is what you get. So when they see me, they go, okay, so Branscombe's in A, B, C, and D. Do I ever get, you know, X, Y, Z opportunities? Not that many. So I take what I am offered or I go and try to get, and I try to flip it a little bit to try to make it interesting. And if I'm going to bomb, boy, I'm going to bomb big.
Oh, man.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's another reason why I don't turn anything down, because when you take a job and you do the best job you can, you meet somebody and you can help them make their dreams come true. And in many ways, you both share a dream that can come true. At her feet.
At her feet.
Make a dream come true. So I think for all of us, it was a great play together as a team. So there's four main characters and two other characters that are main as well. I'm not taking anything from them. Okay. And then the island is the main character. Yeah.
Can you let our listeners know how they can see it? I know there's a screening coming up on the 2nd.
Yes. So you're going to go to the website, At Her Feet, the movie, and we're premiering throughout the island. So we got two play dates on the Big Island. We got two play dates on Oahu. We've got two play dates on Maui. Did I lift anything else? No, I think that was it.
Okay.
And then it's Los Angeles, Oakland, and then it's on all your streaming platforms around the world. Please, everybody, enjoy this film. Much aloha to everybody. And you know what's great is the two characters who are not from Hawaii'i ask certain questions that help those who visually want to see Hawaii. And when they see it, they'll have a question, and those kids actually ask those questions as time goes on. All your questions are answered, and you can get your driver's license at the DMV. But other than that,
the movie is At Her Feet.
At Her Feet.
Branscombe Richmond, thanks so much for coming to the station.
Thank you for having me. They allowed me through the door. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming into the station.
Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Mahalo nui, and God bless you.
That was veteran actor and Maui resident Branscombe Richmond talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about the new film, At Her Feet. The world premiere will take place at the Hilo Palace Theater tomorrow night at 7 p.m. There are additional screenings set for various places around the state this month, but we will have a link to that information on our website later today.
Kalapana is an area so quiet and serene, where families never use the word mean. Togetherness was practiced all day and night. Kaimuku to us is a beautiful sight. Ooh.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, connecting Hawaii with international destinations including Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea. Schedules and reservations at hawaiianairlines.com/international.
Aloha, I'm Anita Rao, host of Embodied, a new program on Hawaii Public Radio. Sex and relationships can be intimidating to talk about, so I am here to lead the way. Join me as we explore our brains and our bodies, a journey that touches down in taboo territory. Embodied is Sundays at 10 a.m. on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in a variety of ways, including exhibition openings and events at honolulumuseum.org.
Coverage of the 2024 Olympics in Paris has much of the world transfixed on the international competition and cheering for their favorite athletes. But one audience that may not be cheering as loud are the American Ninja Warrior fans. That's because Olympic coverage has put season 16 of the sports competition show on pause. For those who need their ninja fix, we are revisiting our interview with Honolulu-based American Ninja Warrior Grant McCartney. Last year, he talked with former HPR producer Stephanie Hahn about how he uses his social media platform to help people with their personal struggles.
I noticed one interesting thing as I was researching you a bit, and you mentioned that you had ADHD, which is really a challenge for many people. And I was wondering if you could maybe share about some of the challenges that you face and also how this characteristic might work in your favor given what you do.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've never really talked about it. I just knew it because by the time I had gotten to college, I was taking higher level Spanish courses where it was all in Spanish. It was, my answers are in Spanish. It's off of books I've read in Spanish. My brain took a while to put it all together, not because I didn't know it. It's because I would go, okay, that means this, and this means that. And then I would go, I need to wash my car later. I need to run to the gas station before I do that. And then I go, wait, I'm taking a test. Okay. And then I come back. Okay, that means this. I got that. Okay, that means this. Okay, well, then that means that this. Okay, I got it. Except for after this, I only got 20 minutes left. Only 20 minutes means that if I don't get this next question within five, then, where was I? And I'm doing that jumping around. Even though I know all these answers, my brain hops. And so they were like, okay, you know, they tested me this one thing and they said, you're the last one to leave the test. And I go, yeah, I'm always the last one. Why? And they go, I was like, I need more time. If I could, I know these answers. I just need more time. And they go, have you ever wondered if you're ADHD? And I was, no, I never tested. I don't know. I get sidetracked from time to time. I went and got tested. They said, you are. And they go, you're going to start medicine. I said, no, I know how to live now. I just, from that moment forward, owned the idea that yes, I get sidetracked and I use it to my advantage. I start something and then I start something. Then I start something. Then I start something. Then I start something. Well, then I just go, okay, add my own direction now. Go back to one, put a little bit more in one. Okay, well, maybe hop to three. Okay, do a little bit at three. Okay, no, go back to two and four needs to happen now. So let's go to four. All right, get four done. And then I just chip away at each one because I bounce around. The only way I can get anything done is to go back and remember and hop. And I take tests that way too. I took a test yesterday at Hawaiian Airlines where you had to do this thing. And I answered out of the 30 questions I would skip. And then I'd pop back when I feel like I was ready to answer and I was in a better headspace. You learn techniques to operate that aren't medicine. I don't need ADHD medicine to say, now I can do it the way everyone else does, which is sitting down, completely focused, because I lose focus. And that's okay, but it needs direction around it. I just need to add my own skill set to now say, hey, inside, you got to go back to question one. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. So through really self-control or discipline, you can operate really well with ADHD. I get a lot done. I just start a lot, and then I got to go finish a lot.
I think it might come also down to you excel in an area that you're really interested in. Once you get that focus, you get laser focused.
Yeah. The jump around is real in your head. And so I have a lot of things that I get laser focused on. And that's okay. I just got to remember to add the self-control to get them done. So otherwise, I just have a bunch of starts. But yeah, it's not, there's ways around ADHD. And it's not even like to think of it as a bad thing. I think of it as a good thing. It's how I get a lot done.
It's a different kind of sport. American Ninja, you're the island ninja. What do you think is the global interest in this?
It's not just repetitive movement of weights. It's not just repetitive. You got to drill the soccer ball kick. You got to drill the catch and the throw. It's always new. And kids and adults alike get in there and they play and they're goofing. And 2 hours later, your body's exhausted because you've been playing and it ended up being a workout.
It's play and creativity is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And you get to problem solve and you get to do it with community and friends because we don't see it as us versus each other. It's us versus the obstacles. So we have great community in this sport. Just search Ninja Warrior in different countries. Also, everyone needs to know that it originated in Japan and that it's called Sasuke. It's not Japan Ninja Warrior. It's Sasuke. That's where it all came from, not from America. Kids and adults can do it together. and it's play, then you get fit through being playful.
What is the thing that you think that you can tell people that maybe people will pay attention to you a little differently because they see you as the island ninja?
Yeah, that's a great question to pick one thing. And as a mission statement for my social media is to build others up. And that's the fact that whatever I put out, I have to run it through that scale. Is it building others up? If it becomes to look at me for the sake of me, that's not build others up. That's, oh, well, I want that car he's got. I want that thing he's got. That's what I drive a 98 Honda CRV. So I don't drive nice things. I have nice things. But there's nothing wrong with having nice things. I just don't want it to ever be a place that people look at me and it's not uplifting to them. The whole point of why I got a Ninja Warrior in the first place is most of my family passed away in a very short period of time. It was my mom, followed by my grandmother, followed by my great-grandmother, who outlived them both. Shout out to her for, you know, holding it down. And then my dad's mom and my stepdad in about a year. A lot of pain, a lot of hurt, and there's no getting away from that. You can't not experience it when it's happening. It's very sad. And it's been 8 years, and it's different now. And in those moments when that happened, I wanted my main thing for people to understand is that it's tough, and there's certain things that are just going to hurt, but that how we love and support each other, you know, the presence of a friend or a phone call or someone sitting in the room or, you know, the ability to sit with yourself and thoughts and ideas and really shift through them and go, I feel so angry. And then you go, wait, it's not anger. Someone I really love is gone and they're not going to come back. And that is hard to think about. Shift through those, and you have to be quiet and alone to do that and sober. Yes, it does get better, but it's not about the light at the end of the tunnel. It's that life has these things. That's a part of what we signed up for being here. And you work through yourself to get those things. Just as much as something horrible could happen, something amazing could happen. Just as equally, the chances are just as equal. So when you do get out of the pain and the fog of a moment, if you're dealing with something heavy and hard, some things can only be solved through community of support. You know, people will stop me and say, oh, I love watching you. And then I go, yeah, thank you. And they're like, yeah, what's your name again? And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You don't know my name, but you saw me once. Or Anthea was like, I love watching you. I go, oh, she probably doesn't know my name or anything. She goes, I love in season 7 when you did this and you had 8 minutes. And I was like, oh, snap, Anthea watches for real kind. And so I big support. Everyone locally has always been so wonderful. Even the uncles out in the water, when I want to catch a wave, they'll give me waves because they know I'm a Ninja Warrior. It's all time. Like, that's the best. That's like the most credited thing ever to me is like, oh, and you're doing that. It's all time. So thank you, everyone, especially locally here for the last 15 years being on island. Just so much love and support. And I'm so thankful for it.
That was Hawaii Island's ninja, Grant McCartney, talking about his journey to Hawaii and how personal tragedy shaped his life and mission. Season 16 of NBC's American Ninja Warrior is on pause right now because of the Paris Olympics, but it will resume airing episodes on Monday, August 12th. I'm a warrior, I'm a warrior. I ain't never gonna stop, give it all I got, cause I only got one shot. I'm a warrior. I'm a warrior, I'm a warrior, American Ninja Warrior. I'm a warrior, I'm a warrior, the rest of the course completed, I will not be defeated, only the strong survive, the competition's getting heated. Well, that does it for us today, but up tomorrow we plan a Hanaho Environment Show from Mauka to Makai. Call our talk back line and give us some feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.